Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So before she was sentenced, WNBA star Brittany Griner had this to say from behind prison bars.
My parents taught me two important things. One, take ownership for your responsibilities. And two, to work hard for everything that you have. That's why I pled guilty to my charges. I understand everything that's being said against me, the charges that are against me, and that is why I pled guilty. But I had no intent to break any Russian law. I want to apologize to my teammates, my club, Gemka, the fans, and the city of ECAT for my mistake that I made and the embarrassment that I brought onto them. I made an honest mistake, and I hope that in your ruling that it doesn't end my life here. Everybody keeps talking about political pawn and politics, but I hope that that is far from this courtroom.
Well, you can hope after that, then she summarily got sentenced to 9 years.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. Yeah, she was arrested in February with less than 1 gram of a marijuana vaping cartridge, which she said was an accident, Dan, because she was packing in a hurry. Mm-hmm. But the judge didn't buy that. She also said she was prescribed this medication, the medical marijuana, for anxiety and to help because she has body aches, you know, because she was in the WNBA, which it's a grueling sport. So she, being sarcastic, but yeah. Whatever. But the judge didn't buy it and sentenced her to 9 years.
Well, can we stop pretending that this is anything other than a kangaroo court? Judge didn't buy it. She's convicted of large-scale transportation.
She could have been lenient. I mean, she could have been more lenient on the sentence. 9 years for that?
Well, right. Are you looking at this like it's an American court of law?
I know it's a kangaroo court.
Yeah.
And it's
so she was.
No matter what she said, they're.
She was found guilty of large scale transportation of drugs. 1 gram. Right. For personal use.
Yeah.
Okay. So what she said at the end, of course, is exactly what it was. I hope this isn't about politics. Well, you can hope it's completely about politics. Of course, it's about politics. And what did the big guy say in response? Oh, Russia, you're bad. That was the big Biden smackdown after the proposed trade of Victor Bout for her and Paul Whelan fell through. Apparently it fell through because you just got 9 years. So it doesn't seem like the State Department's negotiation team is making much headway here.
They said that the State Department had said last week that and that's why she pled guilty right away, she had to be sentenced. She had to have something in place in order for her to be possibly have a prisoner exchange. But I don't know. I mean, first of all, prisoner exchanges, aren't they normally surprises? Like this one has been played out in the media. You know, we'll give you this, but we need this mastermind of evil in exchange for Brittany Yonner and Paul Whelan.
Well, I don't know that that's been confirmed by the State Department who's on the table, but that's been widely reported. I guess, right, the United States is going to have to sweeten the pot. And, you just go back again to the weakness of this president when it comes to Brittany Griner. By the way, you know, for all of, I mean, you know, where's the sports press corps and where's the D.C. press corps and where are all those WNBA stars taking Biden to task? Brittany Griner's partner has, I mean, not specifically exactly, but she's taken the administration to task for not doing enough in her mind to extract Brittany Griner, you know, frankly, before it got to this point. So, you know, the whole, Brittany Griner's was a BLMer and kneeled down, and now there's a lot of people, you know, oh, well, you know, go ahead. You just rot in that prison for 9 years.
I hope she gets out, obviously. Well, I mean, I feel bad for her. 9 years is a lot of time. That's her whole life. She'll never be playing basketball
her whole career.
Her whole career.
Yeah, for the most part. Yeah.
And, you know, if she does, if there's a prisoner swap and she gets out, she better stand up for the national anthem.
She better stand up for the nation.
But she doesn't deserve this.
I agree. I think we need to rise above the politics of this, despite the fact. And it's because this is actually an opportunity to say we understand that Brittany Griner is being held illegitimately by a communist dictator.
Right. And she went to Russia in the first place because WNBA players don't make enough money here in America. So she had a second job, and that was playing sports in Europe. You know, that's what her wife said. That's why she went. She and a lot of WNBA players play in Europe for extra income during the off season.
Stop with the not making enough money. Do we have to go through this WNBA salary thing again? Stop with it not making enough money.
Being sarcastic.
A choice she made.
It's a choice she made, yes.
A choice she made to go to make extra money, which is fine. So, but this is an opportunity to rise above the pettiness. We don't like communist dictators. We don't like Americans being held by communist dictators, being unduly sentenced for a minor infraction. You have to respect the laws of other countries. Not necessarily, actually. Not necessarily. We don't have to respect immoral laws, a politicized justice system in Russia any more than, frankly, we should respect it, even though we have to abide it here. Apples and oranges. But you get my point. Which is to say, no, you respect the laws of other countries, follow the laws of other countries. I get it. She made a dumb mistake. She needs to be careful. She needs to remember where she is, and so does every other American when you're in a country whose regime is hostile to this country, who would look to play politics with other people's lives the way that, of course, a rogue regime like a Putin regime would look to do and is doing. But no, she doesn't belong there. We should get her back. Conservatives should lead the chorus to bring her back, to say, despite our political differences, despite the ignorance of a Brittany Griner previously and the ignorance of most of her supporters, despite the pass that the big guy is getting from the sports press corps, which is just an adjunct to the D.C. press corps. No, she doesn't belong rotting in a Russian prison. She belongs back here and we should get her back. Now, the price of that. Exactly how to do that is a little bit more complicated. I don't want to empty the jail cells of Russian mobsters to get her back either. So, you know, this is where there's some art to the deal, if I could borrow a phrase. Mike in Plano, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan, you know, you're talking about the sports media and where they're at. Well, the mainstream liberal sports media, the ESPNs, you know, your Fox Sports, all your big corporate outlets, and most of your other publications, they are advocating for a release. They are advocating on her behalf, as you would expect them to. The problem is, whenever I look at comments, on Facebook and stuff about this from the general public, they seem to have general apathy towards her. You know, oh, hey, she broke the law. She needs to face the consequences and yada, yada. I'm on your guy's side. I'm on the side that she should come home. She, you know, I don't like her or her politics. But, you know, she's an American citizen, and, you know, what she did doesn't deserve 9 years.
Yeah.
But, you know what, the apathy that's being generated towards her, she brought that largely on herself, because not just her, but that league she was in spent, especially 2020 after George Floyd died, shoving their hardcore left-wing politics down everyone's throat and alienating people, making them feel bad about their own country and their own beliefs, so... There's just not much you can say aside from hope she gets out soon through a prisoner swap or something.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Mike. Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think that analysis is right. But that's why it's an opportunity. An opportunity for people who disagree with her politically to lead the charge because of the standard. She's an American citizen. That is an unconscionable sentence for her infraction. She doesn't belong rotting in a Russian prison, period. That's our position. Let's articulate it. Ed in Oak Brook.
Yeah. You know what, Dan? You're talking about a kangaroo court in Russia and maybe even China, if there ever is a court there. But what about our system? We're no better off. I mean, look at the selective justice in this country. Did they ever charge Alec Baldwin with murder yet? No, he's just sitting out there. Jesse Smollett starts crying in jail. He gets out. Those people on January 6th, many of them are just rotting in prison, as you call it. Well, so how are we even better? You got a Department of Justice that is more corrupt than anything in Russia or China.
No.
So we are no better off at all. I know. Laugh at me if you want.
That's not laughing.
It's a good system.
I'm disagreeing. I'm not laughing.
On what point?
Well, first of all, you conflated so many different cases. So we'd have to extract them. Yeah. January 6th is not Alec Baldwin, is not Jesse Smollett.
But I'm just saying that the difference in the justice system, any other person would have been charged in the Alec Baldwin case.
No.
So I'm saying there's selective justice. Why is he not charged?
Because the facts don't bear out a murder charges as far as we know them at this point.
He gets to kill the girl and then he just
decide.
Walks.
Thanks for the call.
He did not mean to kill her.
Right. And so, chain of custody on the prop gun or what turned out to not be a prop, and so on and so forth. I mean, I don't want to relitigate the Alec Baldwin case. Point is to say, let's not get hysterical. Yes, there are, we've talked about this. We have a problem in this country, particularly at the federal level and in some localities where the charges depend on your political views. And that's a problem. That undermines the legitimacy of the justice system and undermines people's faith in the justice system, which further undermines the legitimacy of the justice system. So, yeah, agreed. But let's not be ridiculous. Let's not go full LeBron here and pretend that because we have grievances with the justice system here that are legitimate, it's the same thing as Putin's Russia or Xi's China. It's obviously not. We have rights enshrined in founding documents. They do not. We have due process norms that they do not. We are not a dictatorship in the way that they are. So let's not compare, apples to orange groves here is the point. Jim and Crown Point.
This really has nothing to do with her. I think she'll be eventually released because I think part of the deal is that she admitted guilt. And Putin is just using this as long as he can to rub our faces in it. And I look for her to be out probably within 2 months. And he will.
Why? Putin's rubbing our faces. And so why would he stop?
Well, no, I'm saying he'll extract something to make us look even worse, you know, and
maybe
Biden and everybody jumped the gun. They, making deals before it was decided. It just shows the weakness of the men in power right now. And she'll be out.
I don't know.
Yeah, I we'll see. I mean, I think he's right in the sense that what is how much genuflection. How much supplication is the Biden administration up for in order to get her back? And frankly, to Mike and Plano's point, how much public pressure will be put on the administration to get her and Paul Whelan, the sort of the throw in on the deal, if you want to use sports metaphors, to get them back? Your mic's not on.
Hi, that would help. I said Whelan's family's been trying to get him back for years.
Understand, he doesn't have the public profile.
Right.
Griner doesn't. So the question is,
they want the 2-for-1. I think it's
a
fair deal.
What will Putin extract? How much does he demand, and what are we willing to do? And we don't really know the parameters. I mean, we've gotten an indication of what was offered, reports of what was offered. We don't have any indication of what the response was or what the counter was. So, we'll have to watch this play out.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com Bankrate.com/mobile.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission: to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So, I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We've got a declaration by the White House that monkeypox is a public health emergency. I'm having a hard time keeping a straight face talking about this. I understand it's a painful rash and so on and so forth, but I also understand there are no confirmed U.S. deaths associated with monkeypox. The public health emergency is the sort of the formal way of opening up resources for a public health response to monkeypox, thus the declaration.
It's a joke. But, I mean, we've, 330 million people in America? 6,600 in all of the United States have monkeypox. That is nothing. 4 people in Africa have died. I'm sorry for that. But to just declare it a public health emergency is nothing more than a joke.
Well, you know, you could say that the public health pros want to be ahead of the curve here, want to nip monkeypox in the bud, as it were. But the public health emergency, it seems to me the issue is the smallpox vaccinations that are used to treat monkeypox. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, not going to gay orgies.
Yeah. So the WHO, the chief, asked gay men, just for 2 weeks, please don't have sex with multiple partners. Okay, so Dr. Wardy had a big press conference yesterday because North Halsted Market Days are coming up this weekend, where you're going to have people from all over the country gather on North Halsted and have a big party. And sometimes, you know, they do nefarious things, Dan. There's going to be about 100,000 people there. And I said, why not just shut it down?
Shut down the festival?
Yeah.
Why?
Because if this is a public emergency, why are we having, we're encouraging this, you know, people to have, I don't know, not encouraging, but people
slow
are meeting
your,
other men from all over the American.
Slow your roll to slow the spread.
Right. Just do your part like we did for a year. We're just asking for 2 weeks.
Given that we don't see this spread based on everything we know now through gathering in bars, through getting together, you know, going to a street party, et cetera, we do not think that it sends the right message to say we're not doing this at all.
Street parties are a gateway to monkeypox. Yeah, I mean, shut it down? No. Why should you shut anything down?
Because if it saves one life,
Okay, so listen
to this real quick. So we have 259 people in Chicago that have monkeypox. 21 are in the hospital, 0 deaths. Guess how many of the 259 are men?
259.
258, one female, but she's a trans. So
that's 259. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
These are the things I learned.
Give us your stories from the front on monkeypox, how monkeypox is impacting your life.
Okay, but then there's this. So Dr. Awardi, she does the math. She came out, you know, we have 13,000 new vaccinations coming. We had already administered 29,000. And then she put up this graph.
Mm-hmm.
Turn on the lights before you turn off the lights.
Yeah.
It's two men sleeping in bed with a light on. And are you ready? If you're having sex.
They're looking suspiciously at one another, too, those two men.
I did tweet this out, too, if you want to see it.
Uh-huh.
If you're having sex, spend a little time with your partners to look for any new or unexplained rash or sores, including your mouth, genitals, and butts.
Uh-huh.
Don't touch any new or unexplained rashes or sores, Dan, and see a healthcare provider.
Mm-hmm.
Sincerely, Dr. Ward.
Yeah.
I mean,
Dr. Rorty, follow up on that. Can you demonstrate the check your partner protocol?
Is this a new form of foreplay? Like,
I mean, I'm just
sitting there going, what?
I want to make sure that I do it right. So if you and your Rona Buster pal could go through the check mouths, genitals, and butts. I mean, just like a demonstration. We could put this out into the public.
What's
then.
Your name again?
So you should do it. Yeah.
And so I asked her, why?
I got it. I'll check my own genitals. Thank you.
I didn't know you were a contortionist. Why isn't the abstinence message working?
Abstinence messages tend not to be successful. We have a lot of data on that, but it is a time to be careful. Having multiple or anonymous sex partners right now would be higher risk in this setting. And I want people to continue to, enjoy the summer, enjoy gathering, enjoy festivals, but understand that this disease in this population, especially right now, there is more of it available. And if you're not feeling well, please stay home.
And wash your hands.
Who can enjoy a street festival without anonymous sex? I think that's just a bridge too far.
We're not asking.
What
we're
are,
just saying it.
What
just
are street
have sex
festivals
with
for?
One person for the next 2 weeks, and we can eradicate this.
Uh-huh.
Think about it, Dan. It's just 2 weeks.
So how is the? I know the summer of joy has been interrupted by violence. It's the summer of joy, trademark, triple threat.
Mm-hmm.
So now we've got a monkeypox overlay on the summer of joy, too. Huh.
Yesterday they asked pastors to please talk about this on Sunday Mass.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
No, they did.
No, of course.
We got to get the word out.
And we intend on doing just that. We don't want this to go into what COVID was. And so
right.
We got to be resourceful. And so that is our goal.
Resourceful.
And that is what we're here for.
Is that the monkeypox czar? Who's that?
He's with the Chicago Health Department.
Of course he is.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
We got to eradicate this. We got to stop it now before this becomes COVID. Don't you get it?
These are public health professionals. They don't know the difference between a respiratory disease and a disease that and a virus that transmits based on human contact. During COVID, were we being tasked to check our partner's butts? Did I miss? I mean, I know there was anal swabbing,
right, for a disease of COVID.
But right.
Sometimes the nostril's not enough. You got to get in there
And
make sure you don't have COVID.
Yeah.
312-642-5600 turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Closed for monkeypox. Okay. Dennis and Crystal Lake, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Danny, Amy. I was overseas for 20 years, and needless to say, I had all three of them at one time. I should have been in the ICU. And I should have a PhD in monkeypox.
Mm-hmm.
And if I would have known that, people actually get to go in front of crowds and get paid for it, they should be seeking me out right now. I'll give them a lot of information.
Mm.
And I'll show them a lot of information.
All right, our resident STD expert, Dennis from Crystal Lake.
Call anytime. I mean, we appreciate your knowledge and your experience, life experience.
I think we're going to do a special on gonorrhea next week, so we'll
and
enlist Dennis
on
to,
week
to
week.
Help.
Yes. Well,
Tom in Blue Island.
Hey, Dan and Amy, they've been pretty good at trying to teach us to stick things up our you know what. Was there any reason she couldn't say that we only need 2 weeks to slow the spread from like about 3 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Tom.
Just 2 weeks. Just do your part. You know, if I wasn't wearing a mask, people would yell at me because I wasn't doing my part. Oh, no. You do your part now. Step up, as Mayor Lightfoot always says.
Well, so, the whole like.
Excuse me. Yes, sir.
It's just the calls to the calls for mitigations, especially with this. you know, impulse control. Mm-hmm. So, hey,
there you go. Impulse control. Control yourself.
Yeah, if you want to continue to live the Bacchanal life, and go ahead, but, you know.
Well, condoms don't help here, just so you know, because a lot of people were.
A lot of people were asking. Yeah.
The press conference. Will condoms stop the spread of. No, they will not help you at all.
Because
if you have an open sore and it gets on your bedding or on a towel and then somebody touches it, that's why 2 kids out of 6,600 in the United States have monkeypox, because their parents had it and they shared a linens or a towel or a blanket on a couch.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very contagious, but, you know, do your part.
Well, I mean, do your part or you get the pride pox.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission: to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So, I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630. And learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Speaking of Summer of Joy in Chicago and other big cities, Norco, California, this has been making the rounds. A guy comes into a liquor store with a mask on, points a rifle at the store clerk, this 80-year-old gentleman, and then this happens.
What do you see, a snake or something?
He's trying to get in the getaway car. They like pull out, and then he's got a
screaming. I want to hear it again.
He comes into the store. He points the rifle. I mean, you see this on the surveillance video. And the guy from behind the counter just opens fire like you just heard. Now,
I think he surprised the burglar. He was a little scared, screaming like a schoolgirl.
I think he did. He grabbed it. He had a shotgun underneath the counter. He opened fire. A good senior citizen, good 80-year-old with a gun. I don't think he literally shot his arm off, but he landed. There's no question about it. I think this guy was later taken into custody because he sought medical treatment. The shopkeeper, though, too, there's sort of a sad part of this. Uh-oh. He had a heart attack after the incident, but he's okay as well. 80-year-old dude after fighting back against Robert. And, you know, we talk about this, that here again, whether you want to be put in a position of having to defend yourself or not, you know, in a lot of cases in big blue city America, those big, beautiful blue cities that are disintegrating before our very eyes, you're going to be put into that position. And this 80-year-old gentleman in Norco, California was ready, wasn't he? You just worry about the continuing loss of confidence in local law enforcement and what that's going to mean for vigilante justice. This is...
Thank God he had a Second Amendment right to carry, because he would have gotten, robbed, first of all, but we don't know what would have happened.
This is his place of business.
Right.
So it's a little, but I mean, regardless, he was ready to defend himself. But the vigilante justice thing, the descending into street justice, that's a real concern. It should be a real concern. By the way, programming note, you're going to want to listen to this. At the bottom of the 7 o'clock hour, we've got Will County State's Attorney Jim Glasgow, DuPage County State's Attorney Bob Berlin. Glasgow's a Democrat, Berlin's a Republican, and they're going to join us to talk about the implications of the Safety Act, the Pritzker-signed Safety Act, which takes full effect January 1st. And as we've talked about, and they'll provide the details, if you're watching from a distance and can't believe what's happening in Chicago, the Safety Act goes into effect. Two things are going to happen. It will get worse in Chicago.
Yep.
And what you see in Chicago is coming out to the suburbs.
And the entire state of Illinois.
Right. But particularly areas where you have real incidents of crime occurring already. So take a listen and wake up out there in the suburbs if you think that you're living or residing at a safe distance from Chicago.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM 560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Two executives and two approaches on the rule of law. Shall we compare Christopher Wray, the FBI director, to Florida Governor Ron DeSantis? We shall. Chris Wray was up on the Hill yesterday taking questions from senators about things like the Hunter Biden investigation, the catastrophic FBI participation in investigation of a plot, the alleged plot to assassinate Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer and the like. Now, remember, Christopher Wray came in as a reformer. DOJ Inspector General David Horowitz, December of 2019, review of four FISA applications and other aspects of the FBI's Crossfire Hurricane investigation, responding to the criticisms that were leveled by Horowitz as to how the FBI's conduct in what we know as the Russian collusion hoax. And in that, Christopher Wray talked about modifying our processes under FISA, where he undertook an extensive review of investigative activity based out of the FBI headquarters. Mm-hmm. Moving forward, in the very rare instance when FBI headquarters runs a sensitive investigation requiring prior approval by the deputy director and consultation with the assistant director in charge or SAC for the affected field office, a special agent in charge. Third, making significant changes to how the FBI manages its confidential human source program. Really? We still have a lot of unanswered questions about the use of confidential human sources, whether it did or did not happen, and to what extent, if it did, on January 6th, don't we? Not to mention, again, the Whitmer plot. Fourth, in this letter, I'm establishing new protocols for the FBI's participation in counter intel briefings and so forth. I'm mandating a specialized semi-annual training requirement for FBI personnel at all levels who handle FISA matters. We'll review the performance and conduct of certain FBI employees referenced in the report's recommendations. Managers, supervisors, senior officials at the time take disciplinary action where warranted. Oh, really? Take disciplinary action where warranted. That was December of 2019, so let's fast forward to August of 2022. And this exchange yesterday between Ted Cruz and Chris Wray on the topic of the FBI's handling of that alleged plot to assassinate Michigan Governor Whitmer.
In Michigan, That case ended up an absolute debacle where the four people who went to trial, two of them were acquitted, two received mistrials. None of them were convicted on even a single charge, and the basis of the defense was entrapment, that the FBI, that paid enforcements for the FBI, had suggested and had incited the conduct. Let me ask you, how many FBI agents were disciplined or reprimanded after that disastrous case and the misconduct that led to every defendant being acquitted or having a mistrial on every charge?
Senator, I can't comment on any personnel matter. I can tell you that that case, as I understand it, is now pending a retrial, as I understand it.
Well, the special agent in charge of that case has now been sent to D.C., to the Washington, D.C. office, and now leads the investigation regarding January 6th. Is that correct?
That doesn't sound right to me.
That does not sound right. The name of the individual is Stephen D'Antuono. He was run out of the FBI Detroit field office. And by the way, I will point out that the lead investigator, Special Agent Track, are you aware that he was apparently fired for allegedly beating his wife after coming home from a swingers party, and he'd made multiple derogatory political posts about President Trump showing political bias? Are you aware of that?
I am aware of, I think, the incident you're describing and action that was taken about it. To clarify on the first part of your question, Mr. D'Antuono was the special agent in charge of the office, the Detroit field office, and is now the assistant director in charge of the Washington field office. I thought you were asking about the agent who was responsible for the
incident. So the guy in charge got promoted and is now in charge of the January 6th investigation.
The guy in charge of the whole Detroit field office is now in charge of the whole Washington field office.
That is astonishing.
It is,
oh,
isn't it?
I hope he doesn't have monkeypox.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. The FBI continues to astound. Yeah, the guy who is in charge of the Detroit field office, so the guy in charge of that investigation, or apparently, according to a jury, entrapment of individuals who were allegedly conspiring to assassin, kidnap Gretchen Whitmer and so forth. That catastrophe earned his stripes to go from Detroit to D.C.
And don't forget, too, that the FBI, two FBI agents in particular, covered for Larry Nassar. They did nothing. They knew what he did. And dozens of more women were sexually abused because they didn't act on the information that they had. Now, the DOJ is not going to charge those gentlemen, but 13 women they're going to sue the Bureau over their failing to follow up. It's a punch in the gut to victims and their family members. I mean, why do we even have the FBI around anymore? Why isn't it dismantled?
That's a question that more people have been asking over the last couple of years. And, you know, this these hearings on the Hill involving people like the Attorney General, people like the FBI Director, they're kind of pointless in terms of specifics, although that was a good moment for Cruz to frame what happened to show sort of the lack of accountability. A Christopher Wray operating as FBI Director, very different than he suggested he would operate as FBI Director in that letter he sent to IG Horowitz 3 years ago that I was referencing. That was just specific to the Russian collusion hoax, but it speaks to a larger question of whether FBI personnel will be held accountable under the law, rule of law, or is this just going to be a politicized agency that is at the service of Democrat socialist politicians? Well, speaking of which, Hunter Biden, I know you're not going to tell us where the investigation stands, and I know you're not even going to confirm whether or not you have the Hunter Biden laptop, but that didn't stop Chuck Grassley and Marsha Blackburn, two Republican senators, Iowa and Tennessee, respectively, from questioning Ray on the topic. First Grassley, then Blackburn.
You'll have to explain to the committee and to the country how you manage this mess and how you'll clean house.
Do you agree that the Hunter Biden laptop was not Russia disinformation?
Now you're asking about an ongoing investigation that I expect our folks to pursue aggressively, and I can't comment on that.
Okay, and you possess the laptop, right?
And he couldn't comment on that ongoing investigation. The investigation has been allegedly ongoing for some time. Characterization, you understand it was not Russian disinformation. You know, the larger point here is, of course, the story that was out last week, which is that the FBI actively worked to suppress the Hunter Biden investigation by characterizing it as Russian disinformation. It would have been helpful to be more specific. And so is that true? And if it is true, is there any disciplinary action that has been taken against those FBI agents? Because that is separate and distinct from the investigation. Is there been any FBI personnel under your charge who violated their professional duties and or the law in connection to the Hunter Biden investigation? It seems to me the point of having a Ray or a Garland on the Hill is not specific cases and the specifics within those cases. It's the larger questions that Ted Cruz was getting to, that Grassley was getting to. Is this an agency that's accountable to itself and, by extension, the American people, or is it not?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 646-36, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Now, compare this to Florida Governor Ron DeSantis,
yes,
who yesterday suspended a Soros-funded leftist state's attorney named Andrew Warren. We are suspending, this is his statement, he's Hillsborough County, Florida. We are suspending Soros-backed 13th Circuit state attorney Andrew Warren for neglecting his duties as he pledges not to uphold the laws of the state. The Constitution of Florida has vested the veto power in the governor, not in state attorneys. We are not going to allow this pathogen of ignoring the law to get a foothold in the state of Florida. And among other things, Mr. Warren said he would not prosecute individuals who help children procure sex change procedures, violation of Florida law. He would not enforce pro-life laws. He's also accused of releasing rioters and other violent criminals, refusing to prosecute them if it fit their agenda.
Sounds familiar.
DeSantis slammed Warren for attorneys like him for their personal conception of social justice over what the law is required. And in point of fact, there's evidence, because evidence is important. Warren signed a statement saying he would refuse to enforce Florida's 15-week abortion ban or its partial birth abortion ban. He put his name on it. He was the only Florida prosecutor to do so. So DeSantis is completely within his authority to do what he did. And that's a statement from the executive in support of the rule of law. If you don't like the law, then change the law. Otherwise, you don't have the rule of law if those in charge with enforcing it can enforce which laws they want and which ones they don't. I mean, I'm not
the right thing.
I'm not, the rule of law is it's the law, and that's the end of the conversation. It's the beginning of the conversation. Is the law legitimate? Legitimate in terms of, is it constitutional? Does it reflect community norms? So on and so forth. These are cases to be made through your state legislatures when we're talking about the states and the governor. And the prosecutors, the judges, are the enforcers and the interpreters. They're not the legislators. I mean, I know this is basic stuff, but we seem to have, many of us have weakened our grasp on this basic stuff. And so what DeSantis is doing, because it will be characterized as, imperious authoritarian rule of Ron DeSantis in Florida. No. You have a state's attorney who said, I'm not enforcing state law. Well, if you're not enforcing state law, then we're going to get somebody who does.
Right. Without rules, there's chaos. He knows better than that. He just is promoting his political agenda.
So there's an executive standing for the rule of law, including our constitutional norms like separation of power, co-equal branches. And you have an FBI director. I understand he's a appointee slash Senate confirmee, but who is in charge of the most powerful domestic law enforcement agency in the country. And he can't even enforce departmental rules, what is required professionally of the FBI, according to, by the way, a number of reports over the years from Inspector General Horowitz, the DOJ Inspector General. And I hope those reports will continue as it pertains to January 6th, as it pertains to the Whitmer plot in Michigan. And we're supposed to trust him and that agency to enforce the law in a properly blind fashion at the federal level for those areas that the FBI is charged with interdicting. Real struggle. I don't think Christopher Wray performed particularly well yesterday. I don't think he's doing much to restore the reputation of the FBI. And the very different Christopher Wray, well, maybe it's not a very different one, but the posture was very different when he came in versus what we're getting from him, which I know is nothing new in D.C., but that still bears identifying. Craig in Mount Greenwood.
Oh, hey, good morning, Dan and Amy, and thank you much for taking my call, Dan. Listen, we're gut shot with this stuff here, with this FBI. I mean, if we thought we had a big problem with the media, the arm of the Democrat Party, this FBI, by looking at all this stuff that goes on and just the different things, I mean, they're protecting themselves. This is the wolf looking over the hen house, and I mean, this Ray, I mean, these people are rotten and through corrupt and everything like that. And this is why we got all these innocent conservative people that, I mean, there's some of them that were doing the rough stuff in January 6th, everything like that. But I think those were infiltrated and everything. Probably some FBI guys there, too.
Well, yeah, thanks for the call. I mean, the bottom line is there has to be a full accounting for FBI operations at some point. Yeah, these investigations that go on in perpetuity or are, technically open investigations on paper, but there's no work being done. And they're supposed to just sort of fade away, fade from the public's mind. And so there's no reporting that needs to be done on what was identified and why there were no charges. I mean, you would be amazed. You would be amazed at, because I've talked to retired FBI guys. You'd be amazed at some of the criminal activity that has been identified when they have particular targets. And I'm talking about Illinois right now. When they have particular targets identified and they have them dead to rights, and then politics enters. Well, this is a high profile person of a certain race in a certain place. We're going to take a pass on this one. The discretion that the FBI has and the politics that play into the use of that discretion. And this predates Christopher Wray. It's not just about Christopher Wray. It's about a culture within law enforcement. I'm talking about on the prosecutor side, sort of the FBI, DOJ, the discretion and how it's used. You'd be surprised and sickened, frankly, about what the FBI and DOJ could have done, and since we're talking about Illinois, specifically in the area of public corruption, what they could have done and what they have chosen not to do. I wish I could say
they're
more.
Criminal.
Robert and Lyle.
Yeah, hi. Well, Lisa Madigan, she's the one that refused, our great attorney general when she was in office, refused to enforce the law about parental notification on abortion. I got a quick question.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
These FBI people are just so sickening. They think they're above the law, and it's the Democratic Party, the media, and everybody else. I got to ask you about the Mann Act. Are they bringing women, that are under the age, that are juvenile, into our state to have abortions. Now, to me, that is a criminal act to bring somebody from another state where it's a violation of your state to get an abortion. Got any idea on that?
Well, the Mann Act is a human trafficking, right? That's for prostitution or... But it's the law is actually prostitution or any other immoral purpose. So,
okay,
it's an interesting interpretation, probably a broader one than you'll get from federal law enforcement. But thanks for the call, Robert. Appreciate it.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The Parkland shooter was sentenced yesterday. Part of the sentencing, there was an allowance for victims' families to make statements, as is customary. And
I remember, too, the FBI got sued and had to pay victims' family members because they knew that he had violent behavior and they didn't act on it. So that was rare, but they were sued $102 million, and that's what the parents got.
The FBI, yet again.
Yet again, dropping the ball.
The prosecutor in the case in Florida asked... the son of Chris Hixon, who is the athletic director of Parkland, who was murdered on that day. His son is a special needs kid, dolled up in a bow tie. I like the bow tie he was wearing yesterday.
Oh, his name is
Corey. Corey Hixon was given an opportunity to speak about his dad, Chris.
Mr. Hixon. Was your father, Mr. Christopher Hixon?
Yeah.
And is there something that you'd like to tell the jury about your dad?
Yeah.
What is that?
It's okay.
Is there something about donuts that you want to tell us?
What was your favorite thing to do with Daddy? Yeah.
Tell him. You can tell us.
Every Saturday we ran to Denny Donuts and walked back.
Okay. Thank you very much.
The testimony from Corey left several of the Parkland shooter's defense attorneys dabbing their eyes. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, you can't forget, this needs to be repeated over and over again, the human cost of dropping the ball, as you said.
Yeah.
And as so many did leading up to that fateful day at Parkland and on that day.
Yeah. Scott Peterson, the sheriff who ran away instead of engaging and shooting him and killing him.
Yeah. What did we learn? I don't know. Some people learn some things and other people, like in Uvalde, didn't learn other things. For more on all of this, and of course, part of the discussion when it comes to looking for correlations, if not causation, for violent crime, particularly in these mass shootings, part of that discussion, people look at kids that are on pharmaceuticals, particularly antidepressants. And so the new studies that are questioning the efficacy of antidepressants to treat the actual underlying issue, much less any of the side effects that could induce psychosis, as is questioned. It's a question. We're pleased to be joined again by Theodore Dalrymple, contributing editor at City Journal, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, author of many, many books, including Life at the Bottom, Romancing Opiates, Pharmacological Lies, and the Addiction Bureaucracy. He's a retired prison psychiatrist across the pond in the UK. That's where he worked. Theodore Dalrymple joins us. Thank you so much for being with us again. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you for asking me.
So let's talk about the antidepressants, the so-called SSRIs, serotonin reuptake inhibitors.
Yes.
And what we believed, or what was consensus opinion about them up until recently, and how much that consensus is being reconsidered, and the importance of that reconsideration.
Yes, well, there have always been doubters, actually, and the doubts have grown stronger, and for a number of reasons.
What are those reasons?
Please elaborate. Yeah.
Yeah. For example, at the time the SSRIs were introduced, it was possible for drug companies to suppress trials which showed no particular benefit of the drug. So what they would do is publish trials which showed a benefit and suppress those that didn't show a benefit, and thereby gave a false impression of the efficacy of these drugs. That, I'm glad to say that is no longer possible now. Now, if they undertake a trial, they have to publish the results. They can't do that. But at the time, they were able to do that and did it very successfully. A second problem, of course, is in the definition of depression itself, because I don't know whether this has been your observation, but my observation is that nobody is ever unhappy. Everyone is depressed. And this is a very important...
Yeah.
This is a very important semantic shift, because depression, of course, is an illness. Unhappiness isn't an illness. And so if you say, I'm depressed, what you are in effect saying is, I'm ill, and therefore someone must cure me, namely the doctor. The doctor, of course, is under increasing pressure to prescribe something rather than nothing. And he's not allowed to prescribe a placebo. That is to say, a drug without pharmacological effect anymore. They, 60 or 70 years ago, maybe a bit more, doctors could quite openly prescribe coloured water to their patients, but they can't do that anymore. And so they have to prescribe something, and they're under pressure to prescribe. Then, of course, there is the mythology that all human misery is the result of chemical imbalance. I mean, if you listen to people talking on trains or on buses, they will happily talk about the chemical imbalance in their brain. No, they probably don't know the chemical formula of salt. And... so there are all kinds of things that go into this rather muddy mixture, which means now that I believe something like 16% of adults in America, but also in other Western countries, are now taking these drugs.
Yeah, and so...
Which is not to say that they're never effective.
And so,
that's
so,
a different thing.
Well, so I guess then what is your opinion about the belief that depression is the cause of low levels of serotonin in the brain?
Well, I don't think there's much evidence in favor of it. And in fact, a recent paper examined the evidence for this and found it to be singularly lacking. Furthermore, it doesn't seem to me very plausible that such an enormous variety of effects can be caused by a simple chemical imbalance or absence or deficiency. It's very unlikely. I mean, human life, as I'm sure you've noticed, is rather complicated. And so to attribute absolutely everything to a very simple theory like this seems to me inherently rather absurd. But I don't know whether you remember a book, I think it was published in 93 or 94, called Listening to Prozac. Do you remember that book?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
By a psychiatrist called Peter Kramer, and he was more or less more or less implying that we are approaching the stage at which we can design our own personalities. And if, for example, you suffer a little bit too much from shyness, or alternatively a little too much from overbearingness, and then you take a little bit of this or you take a little bit of that, and you can design your own personality much as you can make minestrone soup. This all seems preposterous to me, but unfortunately it seems to have entered popular thought or feeling.
Well, do doctors get kickbacks from the drug companies if they hand out a lot of prescriptions for antidepressants?
Well, I mean, the doctors are also responsible, as are the patients. So it's a kind of tripartite problem. And of course, the drug companies are very interested in maximizing sales. That's the first thing. Doctors often prescribe just to get the patient out of the room because they don't know what to do otherwise. And patients, of course, want to be told that there is a very simple answer to their problems. And since all treatments have some kind of placebo effect, it often is the fact that people take a drug or a pill and then they feel better. So then they attribute feeling better to whatever it is that they have taken. So the whole circle goes on and on and on, but there's a cost to all this, not least of it, in my view, the cultural cost, which is that people think that there is a simple chemical solution to life's little problems. And occasionally there is, but this is rare.
Yeah, just going back to Kramer's book, I remember that because this is not very long after Prozac came on the market, and the way it was pitched, both Prozac and Kramer's sort of case studies in his book was, you know, Prozac gives you social confidence if you don't have it. It can make you an extrovert if you're an introvert. So it wasn't even a.
Yeah.
So like you're talking about with the personality design, it's like the things I don't like about my personality, I can change by taking this pill.
Yes, and of course, future pills become. It reminds me, I don't know, I shouldn't tell an old joke, but there's a man who injures his hand and needs an operation on his hand, and he asked the surgeon, doctor, would I be able to play the piano afterwards? And he said, yes, of course, he said. And he said, well, that's funny, I never could before.
Right.
And this seems to me to be about on that level.
Yeah, and so then, particularly for young people, or is there even a divide? I mean, would you say that these SSRI antidepressants, not a good idea for young people to be prescribed them?
Well, I'm not really a specialist in young people, but I have a feeling that no doubt there might be cases where they would be indicated, but I very much doubt that the prescription of them is confined to those very few cases.
Right. Yeah, right. The overprescription, as you point out, the, you know, one in six that are on these SSRIs in America. So what about, we've talked about this before, but just in the wake of these recent mass shootings, including the July 4th parade shooting in Highland Park, Illinois, the role that kids on drugs, if you will, pharmacological drugs, play in these incidents. In your view, is there causation? Seems to be pretty obviously not the case. But is there correlation? Is that something that is part of this discussion when it comes to trying to prevent?
There's a lot of research going into it, but it's an inherently very difficult question to answer. Like, it's rather like the question of whether the drugs prevent suicide or cause suicide, because, of course, people who are taking them are almost by definition not entirely normal, or certainly not entirely happy. So it's a very, very difficult question to answer. I must say that I have my default position is that one should not prescribed these drugs unless there's a very clear indication that they should be prescribed. And that is pretty rare, actually.
With respect to, since this was your specialty, we also just talk about violent crime, generally speaking.
Yes.
And the incidence of violent criminals, it doesn't need to be a mass shooter to qualify as a violent criminal. Your experience as a prison psychiatrist, what were some of the hallmarks of their mental health that you see repeated in your experience, you know, in terms of indicators?
Well, I didn't really, I mean, I did see occasionally people who were, you know, stark staring mad who committed violent crimes.
Yeah.
And they went off to hospital. And they were, I mean, that was pretty obvious. They were deluded or hallucinated and committed crimes in response to delusion and hallucination. And then, of course, there were people who were intoxicated. The relationship between intoxication and crime is actually more complicated than people think, because there are places in the world where people can get drunk without becoming violent and aggressive. And so the pattern of behavior under the influence of alcohol depends on culture, amongst other things. And I don't know whether you've ever been drunk, but I have. And,
and how was
and it? Is never, and how was it? Yeah. Well, actually, I didn't really like it. I found, and so I avoid it now. I thought it was a rather unpleasant feeling. Going to bed with the ceiling going round and round is not very pleasant.
Pace yourself.
Yeah.
And so I hadn't done it for, I suppose, at least 50 years. But but there are, of course, drugs which increase aggressivity. Things like cannabis often can, and cocaine and all the other drugs. So there is that connection. But, of course, the people who take them are probably more inclined to criminality anyway. So the relationship, for example, between heroin taking and crime is very complicated, and it's certainly not that people commit crime in order to obtain their heroin, which is the common view. So so it's a complicated. As for prescription drugs, I have known a few cases where there was a very clear connection between taking a prescription drug and committing an offence, because sometimes unexpectedly a drug that is expected to tranquilise people agitates them, and when they're very agitated they then go and do something illegal. Well, that's a very clear-cut case. But with most of these drugs, of course, they are prescribed for people who are already somewhat different from what we used to think of as normal, although being abnormal is now normal. So it is complicated, and you have to look at each individual case. I mean, I could give you examples, but it's difficult to make absolutely blanket statements.
He is Theodore Dalrymple, contributing editor of City Journal, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and the author of many books, including, perhaps relevant on this topic, definitely relevant on this topic, Romancing Opiates, Pharmacological Lies, and the Addiction Bureaucracy. Theodore Dalrymple, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Hey, Tucker Carlson covered the Live Tour this week, so if it's good enough for Tucker, it's good enough for us.
I mean, we've gone a few days without talking about it. Are you going to be okay?
Yeah,
no. Do you
need
some antidepressants, maybe?
So this week, Bryson DeChambeau and professional douchebag Greg Norman were both on Tucker Carlson.
It's a nice introduction.
Talk about the live tour. Mm-hmm. Well, Norman is just insufferable. Despise that guy. But that doesn't mean that the live tour is a bad idea. It just means that Norman's a D-bag. But it could also mean that, you know, both things. They could be disconnected or they could be connected. Well, that's what we're going to talk about. Here's what DeChambeau said about taking the money and also reconciling the PGA with the LIV. And this is before the announcement that there had been a antitrust lawsuit filed by Phil Mickelson, DeChambeau, and nine other golfers from the LIV against the PGA. Here's DeChambeau's argument.
So PGA Tour is saying that anyone who participates in LIV will be banned for life from PGA Tour.
Yeah, it doesn't make
sense. You're 28. Are you worried about that?
No. I think it'll get figured out. And I personally know that it will get figured out, whether it's legally or whether they come to the table and work out terms. I definitely think it'll all wash itself out in the future pretty shortly. But it's funny. It's so weird because it's like, let's use this as a reference. I heard this earlier this week. You have a pizza shop that's been in existence for 50 years, and all the customers go to, and it's a great product. All of a sudden, a new pizza shop opens up, right? And they start paying the customers to come eat at their place. And that pizza is potentially a little bit better of a pizza, right? And then all of a sudden, that original pizza house goes, if you go over there, we're banning you from ever coming back to our, you know, pizza shop. What's wrong with that economic model?
That does seem short-sighted.
Yeah.
Particularly if you...
Yeah, that doesn't work, actually. Bryson, stick to hit bombing drives, not rhetoric, because that metaphor doesn't hold up. You're not a customer at the pizza shop. You're an employee. Right. And so if the employer says you can't go work at a competitor, then the employer is well within his rights to say so.
Right.
All right.
And if you do go work for them, you're not working for me anymore.
Now, on the matter of blood money from the Saudis to underwrite this league. Greg Norman had this to say.
PGA Tour, I think, has about 27 sponsors on the PGA Tour, do $40+ billion worth of business on an annual basis in Saudi Arabia. Now, why doesn't the PGA Tour call the CEOs of each one of those organizations? Oh, sorry, we can't do business with you because you're doing business with Saudi Arabia? Why are they picking on the professional golfers? Why? The male professional golfers. Females, the LPGA Tour, is sponsored by Aramco, right?
Literally?
Literally. The largest sponsor of women's golf in the world is Aramco.
Aramco is the state-owned oil energy company, state-owned in Saudi Arabia. So he sort of has a point. The doing business with... as a third party, these, you know, multinational corporations versus underwritten by the royal family. There's a difference there, but okay. I think that a review of the PGA's relationships with some of these actors is a legitimate area of inquiry. Norman also responding to Tucker's question as to, you know, why a lot of golfers don't like the LIV Tour and don't like players leaving the PGA for the LIV, and not just your everyday hackers like me, but also PGA pros with standing.
Why is it so offensive to some American golf fans that you're doing this? What are they mad about? Do you think?
I don't know. I really don't care, quite honestly. I just love the game of golf so much, and I just want to grow the game of golf. And we at LIV see that opportunity. We at LIV see it not just for the men, but for the women. We at LIV see it for NCAA and younger generations. We live see it as a pathway to opportunities for these kids to experience a new world out there.
Yeah, well, it's not just golf fans, and I'm glad Greg Norman is indifferent to golf fans. That's long been his position of being indifferent to golf fans, which are the people that made him, you know, just about a billionaire well before the Saudis came along. But that's Greg Norman's attitude because, you know, he's a D-bag. But it's not just fans. Davis Love, who is a Hall of Fame golfer and captain of the U.S. President's Cup team, suggested that he could see a scenario where players boycott a major championship to motivate the PGA and other governing bodies to ban LIV players from competing in them. Because if you don't prevent them from competing in majors, then what disincentive is there for every player on the tour that the LIV wants? Well, I'll go take the Saudi money because there's no downside. I can still compete. I mean, there has to be a penalty, and so you can understand how the PGA is wrestling with this, because you have some marquee names that have taken the money, Mickelson, DeChambeau being among them, most recently Bubba Watson. But by the same token, you have to create barriers to entry in a competitive environment. This is not something that to me should be a matter of law, and I'm all fine with competition. So it's a sort of a matter of preference and whether you think that the LIV Tour and the players going over there is good for the game or not. For more on all of this, we're pleased to be joined by Barry Cronin, who is the editor of Chicago District Golfer Magazine. Barry, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's great to be with you, Dan. It's an honor to be with you and Amy, and to follow Theodore Dalrymple is the highlight of my life.
Okay. Wow.
I mean, unbelievable.
Who knew the man didn't drink?
Yeah, you know? Not anymore. So what do you think about this antitrust complaint filed by Mickelson, DeChambeau, and other LIV players?
Well, I think that, number one, it was inevitable from the very beginning this was going to happen. Number two, there's an immediacy of it, too, because I believe what's going to happen is that there are three players among the 11 who filed this lawsuit in California the other day who are going to ask for a temporary restraining order to enable them to play in the FedEx Cup playoffs, which start next Thursday in Memphis. It'll be the FedEx Cup tournament. And so Taylor Gooch, Hudson Swafford, and Matt Jones, all household names, Amy, you get this? Who they're eligible, actually. They're in the top 125 on the PGA Tour's FedEx Cup points list. So they're actually, theoretically, if they had not been banned for life from the PGA Tour for leaving for LIV, they would be eligible. So it's going to be interesting to see if the a judge in California will allow them to play. And so that's the most immediate thing that we look at. And it might give us a little bit of an insight into whether, the merits of the antitrust case that LIV is prosecuting right now.
So is it your belief that the position of the PGA and the Masters and the Royal and Ancient across the pond there, that they're going to move against these LIV players playing in the majors over which they have governance?
Well, I don't think there'll be an aggressive move, right? I don't think that, although I have to say, during the British Open a couple of weeks ago, Martin Slumbers, who's the head of the Royal and Ancient, came out and really challenged LIV and basically said they don't like it, saying that the LIV Tour undermined the merit-based culture of golf in the world, in professional golf. But they did not, the British Open and the U.S. Open earlier, did not ban players who were eligible. What I believe is going to happen, Dan, is there's such a thing, and boy, oh boy, if the folks don't follow this, the listeners don't follow this detail, it's going to be a little confusing. But there's something called the Official World Golf Rankings. These are points that are assigned to players based on their performance in various golf events, PGA Tour events, essentially, and European Tour events. So if you've got to get those, a lot of people, you have to get those points in order to qualify for the major championships. So, for example, the Masters, if you are in the top 50 in the world, you will be invited to play in the Masters. So, that's one of the ways you would get in. So what will happen, though, is if these guys who are playing LIV are not competing regularly on the PGA Tour, they will not accumulate these points, and they will quickly fall out of the top 100 on the world golf rankings, you know, in the world. And so then they will not be technically eligible for these major tournaments unless they're unless they've won the tournament before, or if they're eligible because, so for example, if you've won the Masters, you are eligible for life, theoretically, because right. it's an invitational.
Right.
But the U.S. Open, the British Open, the PGA Championship, if they've won those events, then they're typically exempt for 10 years or 15 years or life or whatever it is. But if you lose those world ranking points and you don't have the, those exemptions because you're a past champion, then you will not be able to play. So I believe what will happen, though, as part of this antitrust lawsuit, is that they're going to challenge that LIV will challenge the nature of the world ranking points, because the people who, guess who runs the world rankings operation, the PGA Tour, the European Tour, the Masters, the U.S. Open, the British Open, and a couple of other tours, who will, and they'll just say, and the LIV people, if I'm their lawyer, I would say, hey, listen, this is a combine. This is a rigged system. These people don't, they don't want us, they don't want to give us our world ranking points. The problem with the LIV Tour is that whereas all the, most of these other legit tours, like the U.S. Tour and the European Tour, they're playing 72-hole events.
Yeah, exactly, not 54.
Whereas the LIV Tour is playing 54-hole events. However, if you want to get a little bit farther in the weeds, Dan, there are tours around the world that receive world ranking points and in which they have 54-hole events, right? And those events, as part of these other tours, those 54-hole events, guess what? They get world ranking points. Mm. So it's a, you know, we've got a great column coming up in the next issue of Chicago District Golfer magazine, which explains all this and in great detail.
Well, they keep describing, they meaning mainstream media, saying that the LIV Golf Invitational Series is fledgling. Is there a possibility it would shut down?
Well, I don't think it's going to shut down. I don't think it's going anywhere, really. I mean, they have... The thing that they have, Amy, is they have unlimited amounts of money. This is a really different thing than, you know, back in the day, the American Football League started as an upstart against the NFL. And so that was Lamar Hunt and his buddies who basically were taking professional football to smaller markets, San Diego, Kansas City,
right.
A second team in New York, you know. So that was a different thing. That was a real business. And those guys back in the day in the 60s, they would stand under the goalposts at the you know, at these college football games, and they'd sign players underneath the goalposts. And when Joe Namath signed with the New York Jets for $400,000, that was like the biggest thing in the world. I mean, who ever heard of somebody getting $400,000? But the thing is, that was a legit business. You know, those guys were the guys from who were starting the American Football League were businessmen, and they had, and so they sued the NFL, and there was all this back and forth, and they wound up combining because why? Because they're all American businessmen. This is a different deal. This is different because it's not, you know, it's not really a standard business operation. It's, hey, we're this whole thing is financed by the Saudi investment fund.
Yes.
Now the Saudi investment. No, until excuse me, I'm sorry. Until about 6 months ago, the Saudis investment fund had all the money in the world, and now the gas is $6 a gallon. They have twice all the money in the world, so they're not going anywhere. They have invested in Formula One. They bought a team, a soccer team, in England called Newcastle, and they've kind of brought that franchise back. So.
Yeah, it's cultural propaganda that they're paying for.
Well, right, Dan, and that's the whole point. So if you're going to look at this objectively, you say, okay, what is this? What's the purpose of this? And if you determine that the purpose of it is sports washing, which many have, others have said, well, it's part that, but it's also part that the Saudi Arabians want to change their economy because they're going to run out of oil and they want to, you know, diversify, et cetera. There's, you know, you could say, okay, there's a little bit of that. And they're in competition with Dubai, which is hosting a lot of sports events over there, and they want to beat them out for whatever reason. I God knows, I don't know the politics of Illinois versus the Middle East. So it
seems to me, though, I mean, you know, they have unlimited money, and maybe they have unlimited tolerance for not making any return with the commitments they've made, and these, you know, $120 million commitments and things, they're paid out over 4 years, as I understand some of these contracts. But it seems to me, in terms of the LIV Tour's legitimacy, no matter how long it goes on, it's going to be, do they get a TV deal? And even if they get a TV deal, do the fans show up? I mean, at Bedminster last weekend, you know, there was no, very few fans. The tickets were going for a dollar. You know, if you don't have fans, then you don't have a viable sport or sports league. Now, it can make, again, this is an exception. They can continue keeping it viable by just underwriting it, but it doesn't make it substantial. It doesn't make it legitimate in the eyes of the fans, which is, I would think, at least in part, what these professional athletes want.
Well, there's no doubt about it. However, I have to say that I spoke with a writer who was there over the weekend and at Bedminster, and he's been, I think he was at the other events also. He was in London, I know, for the first event. But he said, look, he said, and believe me, this guy's right down the middle.
Okay.
He said, look, he said, you know, it's not that bad. He said, people are saying it's so bad. And he said, it's not that bad. You know, they've got things going on. People are entertained and all that. And believe me, this guy is a traditionalist, just like you and I are, Dan.
Okay.
So he's saying, you know, it's not as bad as everybody says it is. It's entertaining. They've got stuff going on. You know, they've got the concert. They're supposed to have we're supposed to have this event at Rich Harvest Farms.
Yeah, right.
September 16th through 18th. And they're supposed to have a couple of great bands on Friday and Saturday night after play is over, shotgun start at 1:15, et cetera. So he's saying, look, it's not that terrible. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, I'm going to want to go. But what's interesting to me, Dan, I can't believe this. I have neighbors who have young girls, or, you know, just two young girls. One's into golf a little bit. They're going to the LIV Golf thing.
That's
They're
brilliant.
Going to Rich Harvest Farms. I was sort of astonished. She said, don't be mad at me. I said, I'm not mad at you. I just was interested to know. I didn't talk to her in depth about why they decided to go because, you know, I don't want to appear weird, you know, like a neighbor.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't want to really get into it. But I agree with you, Dan, about the lack of a TV contract. That's because these events are occurring. Now, if you have YouTube TV, you can watch them. Or if you don't, you can watch it on YouTube on your laptop. The thing about it is, you know, who's playing, right? If you look at it, I mean, there are some names that you recognize. Sergio Garcia, who hasn't played dead since he won the Masters a few years ago. Mickelson, who is playing terrible. Brooks Koepka's in the mix. But there aren't that many guys. Dustin Johnson, Patrick Reed. Reed hasn't done anything in the last few years since he won the Masters. So you've got a lot of guys that are really kind of marginal. And I was thinking about it last night, that if you sat down and said, hey, Greg Norman brought his list of great players in there and said to a network executive, here's our 48 guys. We have Scott Vincent, Henny Duplass, Sean Norris, all these guys you've never heard of.
I mean,
you know, there are probably maybe 20 guys you could say that if you're a PGA Tour fan that you have heard of. But my point is not to denigrate all these guys, but to just say, if you're a network executive, okay, guys, you have, you know, 20 guys, and okay, you're going to give us a 4.5 hour, 5 hour show.
Yeah, and I'm going to watch Phil Mickelson shoot 80. No thanks.
And Mickelson's not going to win. Okay, you've got your winners have been Charles Schwartzel, easy for me to say, early in the morning, and Henrik Stenson won the other day. Henrik Stenson hadn't made hardly any money on the tour the last few years. And if you look at the number of guys that shot over par in these events, it's like there's a lot. There isn't like everybody's going low. So I think one of the things Tiger said, which is during the British Open, which I thought was really interesting, was he's, and it's what I've been saying, because so I agree with him. He agrees with me. Is why would you practice? What would your incentive
exactly.
be to practice?
Exactly.
You're getting $100 million up front,
guaranteed,
or to explain to people, these are no cut events. A regular PGA Tour, there's 156 guys, the top 70 in ties make it to the weekend. The other guys are out to lunch. So there's an incentive to practice because, A, I got to make the cut, you know, and then, B, I can think about winning.
Yeah, know? And making money. It is a great point that Tiger raised. I'm glad you raised it as well. Barry Cronin, he is the editor of Chicago District Golfer Magazine, as he mentioned, column in the forthcoming issue on this LIV Tour to further the discussion and debate. Barry, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. Hit him straight, buddy.
Yeah, he needs that. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Sports and politics and sports and politics and sports and politics and intersection. Arrogance and ignorance. Arrogance, ignorance, and arrogance and ignorance. Intersection.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Physical security and then economic security, although in civilized states you can enjoy both. In Illinois, you have neither. Let's start with physical security because that's where it all starts. And we've been talking about it. We're going to continue talking about it. It, in my estimation, should be effectively the referendum question on November 8th. Basically, do you want to live in a civilized state that enjoys the rule of law? Or do you want to turn the streets over to predators, to people that prey on other people, like Chicago has? Well, if the Safety Act goes into full effect as scheduled on January 1, then, as we keep repeating, people in the suburbs who think they're at a safe distance from what's going on in Chicago or Cook County, other parts of Cook County, including suburban Cook County, but the collar counties, you think you're immune? Get ready.
No cash bail, detention limitations. And 100 out of the 102 county state's attorneys in the state oppose the Safety Act. That's what it's called. And there's also bipartisan opposition in Springfield on this. And Governor Pritzker tried to explain why he's backing it. You know, we're going to hire more Illinois State Police. You don't just focus on the cash bail, Amy.
Look, what we don't want is for someone who is in jail because they've been arrested for a low-level offense, perhaps, for example, shoplifting, to be held in jail for months, maybe even years, because they don't have $200 or $300 to put up for bail. I think we can all agree that that is not fair. And at the same time, someone who is a wealthy drug dealer that has perhaps committed murder or been accused of it and arrested can show up with a suitcase full of money and get out of jail because they have the money for bail. I think we all agree that that is unfair and inequitable. And so certainly this is what the purpose in the first place of the provision in the Safety Act is about.
That is a nice twofer. That is both a lie and a straw man argument. Because that's not where the basis of the opposition to the Safety Act, and that's also not the thrust of the Safety Act. Oh, the low-level drug offense versus the drug kingpin. No. In point of fact, under the Safety Act, non-detainable offenses would include non-detainable, meaning you're released, burglary, robbery, arson, kidnapping, second-degree murder, intimidation, aggravated battery, aggravated DUI, aggravated fleeing and eluding, drug offenses, drug-induced homicide, threatening a public official.
Nothing in there sounds low-level to me.
No, except Pritzker's intellect. For more on this, the details, pleased to be joined by Jim Glasgow. He's the Will County State's Attorney. He's a Democrat. Bob Berlin is DuPage County State's Attorney. He is a Republican, and they are both in agreement on the Safety Act, what it does, and what we shouldn't want imposed on the state of Illinois. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Jim, let's start with you. You made a comment at an event over the summer, a month ago or so maybe, that if this goes into effect, this law, that you would be essentially turning out 600 inmates at the Will County Jail right now, including 60 murderers. Why would that be the case? 60 people accused of murder. Why would that be the case?
Dan, I got to apologize, but you're cutting out talking.
I'm cutting out? Okay.
Yes.
So I just was going back to a comment that you made at an event about a month or so ago where you said if the Safety Act takes effect, then basically I've got to empty out the Will County Jail.
That's correct. Equal protection under the law. The new statute says that bail is abolished. And if that were to take place, I have over 600 prisoners in the Will County Jail. And I also have victims and witnesses who feel secure because of that. If all those individuals are released and there'd be only maybe about a third of them where we could actually have a hearing for detention, the way the system works, Dan, is, you know, we've got to rely on the ability to protect our witnesses and our victims. They're the lifeblood of our cases. And you can see in Chicago, the reason that they can't solve the crimes there, the witnesses and the victims are terrified to come forward. They know that they probably won't make it to court if they come forward. That isn't the case in DuPage and Will. And so this, if you want an example of what will happen if this law goes into effect, you've got a Petri dish that's been showing you that in Chicago for years. And the last thing we want is that to be statewide.
Have you tried to reach out to Governor Pritzker to discuss this with him?
No, I have not.
With respect to the list of non-detainable offenses I ticked off, the argument from Pritzker and proponents of the Safety Act was, well, wait a second. No. That if there's a high likelihood of willful flight to avoid prosecution, then you can detain the individual charged with the crimes that are that I mentioned, including second degree murder, kidnapping, arson. Is that right?
Well, that's a red herring, Dan. Willful flight means planning or attempting to intentionally evade prosecution by concealing oneself. Where am I going to get evidence of that? Right. That's something we'll never be able to approve. And then listen to the arrogance of this. Simple past non-appearance in court alone is not evidence of future intent to evade prosecution. That's insulting. Judges do that every day. And I would argue that that's unconstitutional. It's a violation of separation of powers where the legislature is trying to tie the hands of the judge and prevent that judge from using their discretion.
Let's bring Bob Berlin on this. Bob Berlin, DuPage County State Attorney. The argument on this claim that you would have jails in suburban communities being emptied under this law if it goes into effect is you number one, if you have people charged with violent crimes, you can still detain, you can still make a court filing to detain them. And number two, you have a 90-day detention term. So what's the problem?
Well, the problem is they've really narrowed the class of people that can be detained. And you can only detain them under certain circumstances. Under the new law, we have to prove by clear and convincing evidence that a defendant poses a real and present threat to the safety of a specific identifiable person or persons. That's an extremely high burden to prove, especially in a domestic homicide where the victim is dead. Who is that defendant a danger to? Who's the specific identifiable person or persons? That's the problem with this law. It ignores a threat to the community because on every single court date, a judge has to make specific findings that the defendant continues to be a threat to a specific identifiable person or persons.
Also speak to, and for either one of you, Jim or Bob, speak to the standards when it comes to policing and the changed standards with respect to police's ability to capture people alleged of committing crimes in the first place.
Well, with regards to misdemeanors, go ahead, Bob.
With Class B and C misdemeanors, the police will not be able to actually arrest the person. They have to give them a citation with a notice to appear in court within 21 days, unless the person poses an obvious threat to the community or any person. Again, a very high burden to prove. Otherwise, these people have to just be ticketed and released.
And Class B and C misdemeanors would include what sorts of crimes?
Criminal trespass is one of them. So a person, let's say, refuses to leave a restaurant, but he's not being very disorderly. The police can go there, ask him to leave. If he won't leave, all they can do is write him a ticket. And then the person doesn't have to leave. They police will not be able to physically remove that person unless they can prove that they're an obvious threat to the community.
But again, Bob, even if they can do that, this law is unclear. Let's say they place them under arrest. We know that there's no mechanism to put them in jail. They can't be detained. So I guess the officer puts handcuffs on them, drives two blocks away, and then lets them go. I mean, that's literally what we're going to be faced with. And when offenders find out that the police are powerless, they'll be 10 times more brazen in committing their offenses.
So what are you both going to do?
Well, we're going to have to do hearings on more than 500 cases where people are currently in the DuPage County Jail. We're going to have to do hearings on only those that can be detained. And the unfortunate reality is many of these defendants are going to be released. Many defendants who are charged with serious felonies will be released. And if they don't show up in court, right now it's a felony offense. It's one class lower than what they're charged with, but under the new law, it's a misdemeanor. So you can be on pretrial release for a murder, and if you don't show up in court, it's only a misdemeanor offense.
Hey,
and again,
go ahead, Jim.
When they don't show up, we no longer have the ability to get a warrant. We have to get a rule to show cause, and it's a basically civil process, and try to get an officer to go serve that. And it has to be served 48 hours before the court date. So that puts another restriction on it. But we don't have enough police officers to be running around trying to serve rules to show cause on everyone. And quite literally, the way the law appears to read, even on these misdemeanors Bob was talking about, if they don't show up for court on their summons, we can't get a warrant for them either. We'd have to do the same ridiculous process. And then when you're talking about violent offenders, you can't ask police officers to go into a situation where they can't use force. They have to knock on the door and say, please open the door. I have a piece of paper for you. It's quite different when they have a warrant. They can get whatever force they need to execute that warrant. So it literally is going to shut the system down the way I see it.
Well, on the policing side, let's stick on that for a minute, too. Just in terms of these shifting standards, Bob was talking about these heightened standards. The shifting standard on things like use of deadly force under this law.
They did change the law on when a police officer can use deadly force. Under the new law, officers now have to evaluate each situation in light of the totality of the circumstances in each case, which includes proximity in time to the use of force, to the commission of a forcible felony, and the reasonable feasibility of safely apprehending the subject at a later time. So in a emergency situation, a split-second decision, an officer has to be thinking, am I able to reasonably apprehend this person at a later date?
at a later date.
What does that even mean?
If I'm trying to apprehend someone, it would seem like that's an exigent circumstance to begin with, right?
Yeah, it makes it, it's very difficult. It's very difficult to train police officers under this new standard as to when they can use deadly force. And they're put in situations where they often have to make split-second decisions.
Now, I don't want to get too political, but why do you think Governor Pritzker is doing this? Mr. Glasgow, do you
look,
want
to... you know...
Well, again, the governor signed the bill, but he didn't write it, and he didn't pass it through the legislature. I think we've got a lot of people that need to look at this. I'd just like to mention, too, on the use of deadly force by police, they've also added that the word imminent requires that the you must have to instantly deal with the issue, and they indicate that you cannot consider future harm, no matter how likely or how great. And I'm not completely sure what that means, but it sounds like if someone's running away and they're far enough away from the officer, even if the officer saw him commit three murders, he's not instantly in danger, but the person's running towards a daycare center. Well, that's future harm, and you can't consider that, no matter how likely or how great. So you tell me what the officer's supposed to do. We don't know. There's no case law on it, and it creates a very dangerous situation for the police on the street.
I'd say. So you have, Governor Pritzker didn't write it, and he didn't pass it, but he did call people opposed to it, which would be 100 of those 102 county state's attorneys, including you two, fearmongers. Nothing to be so he's basically saying there's nothing to be afraid of with respect to this law. It's just, for example, the example that he gave, making sure that the low-level drug offender gets the same treatment as the drug kingpin.
Look, the reality is there's extremely few defendants, if any, who are being detained in our jail right now on some low-level offense. The people who are in custody are in there for serious crimes. And the reality is we've seen what happened in New York. There's no reason to believe that Illinois' experience will be any different. We are going to have violent criminals out on the street who cannot be detained. And the research has shown that many of them repeat. They commit more violent offenses, and the public is going to suffer because of that, because judges' hands are tied. There are categories of offenses where even if a person is clearly a threat to the community, a judge will have no ability to detain that person. And the judge is supposed to be able to balance the right of an accused to go free on bail against the public's right to be safe. And unfortunately, they're not going to be able to balance those factors in many of these cases.
I mean, look what happened in New York. There was an assassination attempt on a gubernatorial candidate, and the judge let him out a few hours later.
Well, and Jim, I know you've made this point, so I'd like you to make it just to make this concrete. With Drew Peterson, was plotting to assassinate you. And under this law, if he hadn't been in prison, he wouldn't be in prison.
That's absolutely correct. And if you go back to his murder trial, he was in jail for 3 years on a $20 million bond. That's the most difficult prosecution I've ever handled. And there's no way in the world that I would have weathered that storm had he been out of jail. In fact, on the over here, when he was captured by the FBI, when they were discussing my murder, he said if he was out on the street, he'd take care of it himself. And then he referenced back to 07 when it all started, and he was going to take care of it then, but he couldn't slip the media and the police. So there's real danger at all levels here when violent offenders cannot be held. And, Lori Lightfoot, she said it very eloquently just recently, about a month ago, that it's we need to pressure the criminal court judges to lock up dangerous, violent people and put them out and not put them out on bail or electronic monitoring. And back in the very same communities where brave souls are mustering the courage to come forward and say,
this is the person who is responsible. That's what I was referring to before. My witnesses, my victims will be terrified. My ability to put together a case will crumble.
And since you mentioned electronic monitoring, last issue before we have to let you go, what is this 2 days off on electronic monitoring provision?
So your defendants will get credit for all the time that they're on electronic home monitoring, and they get at least 2 days a week to go run errands and take care of personal business, personal necessities. They're allowed to go to the grocery store or go to classes, and they're still getting credit for time spent in custody.
Against any jail time they would get, any sentence.
Correct.
That, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
or drink at
Correct.
The beach, the couple I ran into on electronic monitoring.
And if they're in violation, we have to wait 48 hours. They have to be in violation for at least 48 hours before we can charge them with escape.
This is sickening what's going to happen.
Jim Glasgow, Will County State's Attorney, Bob Berlin, DuPage County State's Attorney. Gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us and explaining the particulars of this, this legislation that's takes full effect January 1, as we've been saying. We appreciate your time.
All right, thanks.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you, and they both joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, 528,000 new jobs in July, according to the Department of Labor. Unemployment ticks down to 3.5%.
Who's buying that?
It's all good. The market's bouncing back. You've seen a rally in the NASDAQ, and, obviously we're not in a recession, according to the Biden administration, and we got a healthy economy, they say, and everything with respect to quantitative tightening to interest rate cutting anticipated next year is going according to plan. So it sounds like we have an administration that's sticking the landing based on what the market feedback is, what the jobs number is. Happy days are here again.
Yes. Woo!
All this talk of green stagflation. What's stagflation? For more on this, Jim Perry, Senior Vice President and Partner at Arbor Research, joins us. James, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan. Good morning, and good morning, Amy.
Are you? Have you gone from bear to bull over the last week?
Well, we've certainly had a good bull market in the stock market, and I think that's making everybody happy. We've had a really, really good bounce in the last month or so, which has been very, it's been making the headlines, right? It's very, very visible, which is great.
Yeah. So, and then this jobs number, which exceeded street estimates, and that's a big number. So that's a good thing. We want people to work. So what does it all mean?
The jobs number was good. 500,000 new jobs is terrific. I think it's going to get a lot of attention. The employment report, by its very nature, demands a lot of attention. It's the one number per month where you get an economic advisor on the lawn of the White House talking about it, because the government really, it's they're unlike the Fed or the market. The government wants to talk about job creation and the good job that they're doing. So it gets a lot of attention. I think the trend of employment in this country is slowing broadly, but the last month and this summer, it's been very, very good. So that's a good sign, and you'll hear some positive reports out of the White House. The problem is not about jobs. I mean, it's a tricky number, but, the labor force participation rate, right, is 62.1%, and that's down from last month. That tells you is there's actually more people leaving the workforce than joining it. And that doesn't get the headlines, but it's really the trend in the market, right? So that's something that economically you have to pay attention to. And I think part of that is that expenses are just so high, and the people that have worked and have assets don't really want to go into the big cities. So I think employment is good. The stock market being up is good, but the macroeconomic backdrop behind the whole thing is deteriorating.
So the market not so interested in economic growth anymore. I feel like the Dr. Strangelove of economics. I'm learning to love negative growth.
It's all about the narrative, right? About the narrative.
Well, this whole we've had this little bounce, and everybody seems to be like, okay, this is all good, and things are going in the right direction. We've got two quarters of negative growth, and it's like, yeah, no big deal.
Yeah, I mean, let's face it, the economy's shrinking, and the reason for it is that real wages are falling. I mean, they've never been worse. I mean, wages are dropping by 3%, 4%, and 5% per quarter. And it's not that people aren't working and they're not making money, minimum wage is up and that sort of stuff. The problem is that inflation is just a crusher. It kills everything economically, and it is getting worse rather than better, and that's a big problem. It doesn't make the headlines very much, but, the stock market's up in the last month because the Fed policy really remains extremely accommodative, right? CPI is at 9.1%. That's consumer prices. And at the wholesale level, producers, prices are rising at 11.3%, right? And most of those prices are being passed on to the consumer. The guy that goes to the mobile gas station and fills up his tank and then picks up, a Coke and a hot dog or something. And those prices are going up, and disposable income at the household level is getting crushed.
Well, and what about the housing market? I heard there's a little bit of relief if you get a 30-year fixed mortgage rate. That's good news.
The average mortgage rate in the country has come down to about 5% again. It was probably a little bit closer to 6, probably mid-June, when the 10-year Treasury was yielding at sort of 3.5%. The Treasury rally is really one of the reasons why the stock market has done well. Treasuries have rallied 70, 80 basis points from the worst levels in June, and that's translated directly into the mortgage market. The problem with that is that affordability in the housing market has gotten to the worst levels in this cycle. And if you talk to real estate people, traffic through houses that are for sale and houses that are being transacted, existing home sales, are getting crushed. They're down 7 or 8% per month here in the last 3 or 4 months. So the housing market's expensive, and it will continue to be expensive in places where people want to live. Go down to Miami Beach or, Austin, Texas, housing market's hot. But not very many other places. California is peaking and falling. New York is peaking and falling. Illinois is peaking and falling.
Oil is peaking and falling. It's under $90 a barrel, but that's still three times what it was when Biden took office. So when do we see, in your estimation, relief at the pump? And then, of course, the larger question, when do we see inflation back to where it was when Biden took office,
right,
which is about a fifth of what it was when what it is present?
Exactly. Yeah. That's really the big question, right? When does inflation get back down to the Fed's target of 2%, right? And it's tricky because we've had this, unbelievably volatile period in the last 2 years, where in 2019, just before the pandemic, the economy was actually falling into a recession in Q4, 2019. That's when the Fed did QE4, right? QE infinity. So the Fed's balance sheet gets up to $9 trillion. Because it's $10 trillion worth of stimulus over the last sort of 24 months. And the big story is, that's going to get unwound. The quantitative easing era is over, and the quantitative tightening era has begun, started in March with the first Fed hike. The Fed is going to raise rates so inflation sees a meaningful downtrend toward its target of 2%. So interest rates are going up, and eventually that's going to hurt stocks and housing.
Well, and but how much of that has been built into expectations?
Boy, that's a good question too, Dan. I would say that the stock market has kind of looked across the valley through this trough. And I think the reason for it is, the other real big question out there is, you know, will the Fed chairman, will Jerome Powell have the fortitude to stay the course to reduce inflation down to 2%, or does he capitulate? And the market's telling you he's going to capitulate, which isn't a bad bet because they tend to, right? But I think they're looking ahead a little bit further than they're getting ahead of themselves, as they say. And I think that the first thing you have to do going into the end of the summer and into the fall and the fourth quarter is you got to see about the three more rate hikes that are scheduled to come this year, right? You're going to get a rate hike, probably 75 basis points on September 21st. And then the election, just before the election on November 2nd, there's a Fed meeting and December 14th. So you've got three meetings, and the market expectation is that you're going to get at least 50 basis points, and that's come down from 150. So I think at some point between here and the end of the year, you're going to get at least 50, if not 100 more basis points of tightening, and then you got to say, well, what does that do for expected earnings going forward? And what does that do for home prices? And what does that do for inflation? I think the market is telling you inflation is going to come down in 3 months, but the market always hopes for the best. I mean, in England, I don't know if you saw, the Bank of England hiked rates 50 basis points yesterday. That's because their CPI number came in at 9.4%. Mm-hmm. And unlike the Fed and some other central banks, they actually forecast that by October, consumer prices in England will be 13.3%. So everybody thinks inflation's peaking, and they've been thinking about transitory inflation for a year and a half or 2 years, and now they're talking about peaking inflation. And I think the optimism toward that is purely hope, you know? And I don't know if that's an investment strategy. So I think I really want to watch these inflation figures. We're going to get them next week, right? CPI comes out on Wednesday. Maybe it's peaked. I hope it has. But, you know, with this energy crisis that's going on in Europe, I mean, I don't know. Here's a really quick point for you. I know we don't have a ton of time, but I was looking at natural gas prices, which is, you know, 40% of what we use in energy comes from natural gas here now. And natural gas prices in this country are about $8 per unit, right? I'm not going to get into the unit thing, but it's about $8 per unit. That same unit in Europe is $200, right? In dollars, right? So this is about transporting energy to places where it's needed, where it's not coming from Russia anymore. And mm-hmm. I think to assume that that's going to disappear anytime soon is pure folly.
And the Fed may be tightening. The federal government is not, of course. They never do. So this this latest scaled down Green New Deal gambit, $750 billion in subsidies and you know, transfer payments to bureaucracies and so forth. What sort of impact does the continued spend on the fiscal side of the House have on the reduction in inflation, the Fed policy?
Well, I'm not sure it does anything for inflation. I mean, it seems to me, and I'm not a policy expert, but just reading through the analysis that I've seen over the last week or two on this, it just seems like another tax and spend story that doesn't affect inflation or growth whatsoever.
Except negatively. Except potentially negatively. And it doesn't affect it in a positive way, right?
Right. When you're transferring wealth, that means you're moving more money to the non-productive sectors of the economy from the productive, which means slower growth and slower wage growth and slower job growth.
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward. It evades the understanding of some. It's a frustrating thing. James Perry, Senior Vice President and Partner at Arbor Research. Jim, thanks as always. Appreciate your insights.
You bet, Dan. Thanks very much. Have a good weekend.
Thanks. You too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer, on AM 560. The Answer.
Open mic! Open mic Friday! Call in now! Open mic Friday!
Dan and Amy, top of the morning. It's that time of the week. Open mic Friday, taking your calls. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. Comments, compliments, criticisms, concerns, general crack pottery, we'll take it all. By the way, I saw Dave Kolsak last night at Park Ridge Country Club.
Oh,
Mr.
you did?
Turnkey.pro.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know what?
I got to call him back.
Yeah.
Doing well?
Yeah, he's good. He's good.
What were you doing at the Oak Park? Or what?
Park Ridge Country Club. Yeah. That's none of your business.
Oh. That's rude and dismissive.
Vin Scully, legendary broadcaster, Vin Scully, passed away this week. And so... Just a highlight from a great life lived was, and Vin Scully was a great American, great patriot, too. You recall that he said he was done with the NFL when those kneeling for the anthem moves were being made. Vin Scully said that. He also said this. This is now Hugo Chavez died about 2013, so this is a while back, but Vin Scully broadcasting a Dodgers game and just sort of making an off-the-cuff remark as news was coming over the transom about starvation in Venezuela.
Socialism failing to work as it always does, this time in Venezuela. You talk about giving everybody something free and all of a sudden there's no food to eat. And who do you think is the richest person in Venezuela? The daughter of Hugo Chavez. Hello. Anyway. 0-2.
Anyway, I had swung and a miss.
Hello.
0-2.
Hello.
Good for him.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Did you have something that you'd like to contribute to Open Mic Friday?
Well, you kind of rolled your eyes. You poo-pooed it, as you often do when I speak. Mm-hmm. But I wanted you guys to meet our new Dr. Ezekiel. Mm-hmm. His name's Dr. Vora.
Gee, I wonder why I roll my eyes. I wonder why I poo-poo.
No, Dr. Vora. Dr.
Uh-huh. Dr. Vora.
Another
Dr. Coxtosin. Yeah, okay.
Another pediatrician.
Okay.
But he also has a law degree. He also has a degree in public policy.
Okay.
He doesn't speak Spanish because we just got everything
in
English.
Is there a point to this?
Yes, he doesn't want to be Dr. Ezekiel. He's his own man.
And her dedication and caring was something that I think made me want to be part in serving our residents. But I think we're all better off if I'm not with you all every day. It means that we're doing well. And so I'm happy to be here as much as the governor and the general public needs me.
And he lives in Springfield, so I don't think we will be seeing him every day like we did with Dr. Ezekiel. Thank you, and goodbye. And I'll drop the mic. Are you done rolling your eyes? You might get a headache. You might lose your vision, Dan.
Right. Make that face. The face is going to stay that way.
Yeah. 312-642-5600. If you can't get through, keep trying, because once we drop a call, there another line opens up.
What was that movie? That was One Crazy Summer, right? Where if you make that face, it's going to stick that way, and then you slap the little girl on the back, and then her face stayed that way. It was One Crazy Summer, John Cusack movie, before he was,
totally
an outspoken
woke
leftist goof, speaking of people kneeling before the anthem or sitting down for the anthem
at
Wrigley, like a D-bag. Larry and Elmhurst, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning. Hey, that no cash bail, all that does is now, and if you don't have a CCW, just carry a gun on you anyway, because the odds are they're going to let you out of jail anyway, even if they catch you with it.
Yeah, that's right. Thanks for the call, Larry, referring to our conversation with Will County State's Attorney Jim Glasgow and DuPage County State's Attorney Bob Berlin on bottom of the 7 o'clock hour. Very illuminating on the Safety Act. This is something that needs to be disseminated so people understand just exactly what is coming down the road and have that understanding before they cast their votes in November. Kevin, Austin, Texas.
In response to the state's attorneys, the Bob and Jim show,
So that was passed by the legislature, right?
Yep.
Okay. And then this, the president of the Senate is Don Harmon, who lives in North Oak Park, not in South Oak Park. So he doesn't really care how this is. It's not going to affect him. And I think part of Don Harmon's district runs through Elmwood Park and Melrose. I think Sean Thompson should move back and register so Don Harmon actually has somebody to run against, because the Republicans have never run anybody against Don Harmon. This guy needs to be made famous. This guy goes to St. Giles. He's a Catholic, and he's passing all this stuff. And then nobody knows who he is.
He's a Catholic.
He's, I think, somebody. He should be the next guy in your instead of the Madigan song. It should be now Don Harmon. He needs to be famous, because it's guys like this and also Chris Welsh who aren't going to be affected by these policies or by these laws.
Right.
And they're the ones that are getting the stuff passed.
Right.
Don Harmon. He needs to be made famous.
Thanks for the call, Kevin. Karen and Beecher.
Good morning, Dan and Amy.
Oh,
this is Karen.
That's a munchkin line.
Oh, I love the munchkin line.
Can we ever correct this?
I mean, Karen, can you talk real slow?
I'll call my friend Dave Kolsak. All right, Karen, go ahead. Sorry.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. This is Karen from Beecher, reporting live from Beecher, where we have zero cases of monkeypox currently. I wanted to invite everybody to my monkeypox-free garage sale. They will know exactly where I'm at by following my yellow signs. And also, too, if you don't see me today, come and see me at Uncle John's Flea Market in Cedar Lake, which is right next to where... Don't tell anybody. John Cass moved to Indiana. Awesome. Love to see you here or there.
Thanks for the call, Karen. Appreciate it. It's nice to hear from the Oompa Loompas.
I mean, we got to get that fixed, but yet then it's so entertaining.
Barbara, may I call you Babs, in Aurora?
Yes, you may. Hi, Dan. Hi, Amy. Great show. I saw a segment on WGN last week about Roberto Clemente's high school's library.
Right, it's been closed.
Has been closed for something like 16 years.
13 years, but yeah.
13. Okay. Yeah. I didn't know if you guys had seen that. And, you know, you always talk about the schools and how bad it is and all this money. We can't have a library open for all the money we give to the schools. It's just insane.
Thanks for the call, Barbara. If only there was any interest in using such an institution, I suppose. I mean, but to her point, where are the kids going to go for Drag Queen Story Hour? That deprivation cannot stand.
Oh, by the way, that's coming back Sunday.
Sunday where?
She got a permit.
The bakery in Lake in the Hills?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, good for her. Good luck with the business in Lake in the Hills, making it ground zero for drag queens and, you know, family time with drag queens. Okay, sure.
She thinks it's important.
Fine. It's her right as an American. Shout it from the rooftops. Make, pastries that are reflective of your commitment to gender identity politics.
Be sure to
knock yourself out.
Check yourself.
Make sure,
the heathen region before you go in.
Make sure to do your partner butt check.
You got to do your part. Don't be selfish.
No, that's right. Save one anus.
Yep.
Yeah, it's worth it. Rich in Indian Head Park.
Yeah, good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. What I wanted to say, these policies that they have now by letting these criminals off without any responsibility for what they're doing, I compare it to... talking to your little kids and telling them that if you don't stop doing that, I'm going to count to three. And then when you get to three, there's no consequences. There's no punishment. That's what I compare it to. That's exactly what's going on with these policies that they have now. These people need to be held responsible before more innocent people are really hurt or even killed.
November 8th, thanks, Rich. Thanks for the call. November 8th, Steve, Northwest Indiana.
Don't you guys have any doctors over there named Smith or Jones?
Yeah, right, so Amy could pronounce their names? Yeah, right.
Easier,
yeah.
Easier.
All right.
Wait, okay, I called about one thing, but something else came up as I was waiting. You guys keep mispronouncing the name of the Secretary of Transportation. It's Booty Gig.
Yeah, that's not bad. I like P-Butt. but booty gig, yeah, that's pretty
booty
cool.
Gig's better. But, yeah. Okay,
all
look,
right, all right.
I think I witnessed some industrial espionage a couple of years ago, but I didn't report it to anybody because I don't trust the FBI.
Okay.
I don't want to end up in Lon Horiuchi's crosshairs.
Oh, boy, a Randy Weaver reference. I haven't heard one of those
there
in a while.
There you go.
Yeah, all right. Thanks, Steve. Appreciate it. Chadwick Moore's Monkeypox. Liberici.
Liberici.
Yeah, that's a good.
Liberici.
I like that one. Elliot and Walnut and Wilmette.
Elliot. We represent the Lollipop Guild. I'm calling in reference to the Soros coming back up from the swamp to double down on his sending money to all our elections. I'm with people like that from outside the country, or even outside the state, interfering this way. I fear for representative democracy, you know, staying alive here. We don't seem to be able to make choices of our own with our own things. That's all I had.
Thanks for the call, Elliot. Frank, Arlington Heights.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, you brought up Vin Scully earlier. The absolute best. I used to love watching baseball with him every Saturday. It would be him and Joe Garagiola.
Oh, yeah.
On NBC. That was just the best as a kid to watch. Brought me back to thinking about, you know, just I think it was Friday nights or Saturday nights. It would be you'd wind up having Strictly Business, and then the wrestling would come on. That was great.
Friday Night Sunday, Videos. Remember Friday Night Videos?
Is that Friday?
Oh,
Friday
Night Videos. That was appointment television.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then we'd have Strictly Business. We'd have to go through that for like 20 minutes. And then it was the wrestling, which always happened to end within the allotted time. Just, you know, for whatever reason, those matches always lasted,
yeah,
you know, an hour and a half, no matter what. I mean, never went overtime.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. But, almost like it was scripted,
it was also,
right?
Almost, yeah. It was also, and then on Sunday, you'd have Gian Greco with Sports Sunday, and that would last till 10:45. And then I think George Michael Sports Machine would come on.
Sports Machine.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You walked in,
and
pressed the reeler.
My brother and I, when we were kids, we thought we could be SNL hosts. So we did comedy with stuff. And so we did the George Michael Sports Machine, but we did it with the other George Michael, the guy from Wham.
Oh, yeah.
So my hair is almost as long right now as George Michael's back then. I just get those sunglasses on. I have the George Michael Sports Machine. You know, we'd have our little scripts and we'd be talking about football, but you know, we'd press the little buttons on our fake machine, and the video of sports wouldn't come up. You'd have Jitterbug would come up, or I Want Your Sex would come up, or it'd be a big mess. So, yeah.
That's
good old great. Days back in the 1980s.
Yeah.
Frank, when do you go back to school?
Yeah.
When do you go back to teaching?
August 15th, week and a half. So.
Mm-hmm.
We've enjoyed our summer with you.
How does how do people treat you in the faculty lounge at school, Frank?
Oh, they love me.
Do they?
They love.
You're a beloved figure. Yeah. Oh, that's good to hear. All right.
Why do you do impersonations?
Thanks for the call, Frank.
Oh, did you think
probably does impersonations of other teachers or
which is
the
probably,
administrators.
Yeah.
You know.
Or the principal. That's a good one. Cause a lot of laughs.
Maybe some of the kids.
No.
Oh, that would be mean.
That's bullying.
Glenn in Oak Brook.
Yeah, hi, guys. Who are the two state's attorneys that approve of that January 1st law? And can we have an amendment that says nobody in political office can have a bodyguard ever again?
Mm.
Oh.
Well,
it's think about it. Kim Fox will give you that one, and the second one is
Eric Reinhardt. El Reinhardt in Lake County, who, by the way, was so proud of himself for getting $5 million bail attached to the Highland Park shooter, but he's otherwise, you know, turned the criminals out of Lake County jail because he's a Democrat socialist social climber scumbag. Thanks for the call, Glenn. Yeah, but those are the
like
two out of 102.
Scumbag. Yeah,
two out of 102.
102 counties in this entire state. Those are the only two who love this idea. They think it's wonderful.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah.
Mike in Griffith, Indiana. Hey, Mike.
Hello?
Yep.
Oh, hey, Dan. Good morning. Good morning, Amy.
Morning.
I was going to say that remember last week, 2 weeks ago, when Bubba Wallace met with Lori Lightfoot?
Yeah.
I was going to say, they already had the trophy made up. She was holding the garage door open up high over her head with 15 FBI agents standing around her, helping her hold it up.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Rich and Niles.
Yeah, the thing I was calling up about is they're trying to bring down the cost of gas for your car, but natural gas costs me $180 for 1 month, and I keep my house at 70 degrees during the day and 65 at night. What are you going to do about natural gas? How are those windmills going to fix the natural gas? How are those solar panels going to fix the gas? It's going to go up even higher this coming winter.
Oh, I know. And it's going to be brutal.
Thanks, Rich. Appreciate it.
Natural gas increased 42%. That's what I learned in the news. 42%.
Chuck in Delavan.
Oh, hi, Chuck. How's your campaign?
Hey, the Tangerine. Oh, it's going good. Hey, the Tangerine Jesus is in Waukesha today, just to let everybody know. I'm not there because I'm working as a construction superintendent somewhere, so I can't go. Hey, times have changed about chasing people in the old days in Chicago at the CPD. I don't know if you guys used to remember, but they used to jump out of the car and fire a couple warning shots into their legs. And now they can't even go after them, especially the guys in the white shirts. You remember the guys in the white shirts, the white cops? Shirts compared to the blue cop shirts. You know the difference?
Yeah, the blue the blue shirt cops are the cops that are doing all the work.
No, the white shirt cops are the guys. They give them a white shirt after they know that they've eaten 100,000 donuts. big weekend, like I said, on the 19th. Make sure you go to the Venetian Facts Lunchbox Bullies, the best party you're ever going to be at, and go out dancing and have some good times this weekend. You guys enjoy.
Thanks, Chuck.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.